who actually are paying attention to the course outline, which, hey, who does that? But some of you may be looking at that. If you're looking at it, you would see that a week from today, on Thursday of next week, it says that we have campus tours replacing that class period. And it gives a date for those, which is actually this Saturday. Well, of course, we did campus tours way earlier in the semester. So we made the decision we needed to get that earlier so it could be helpful on some of your short answer question preparation. So we're not doing that next week. So we will have class in here at the regular time on Thursday, a week from today. And we will not have any campus tours this Saturday. We've been there, done that already. So just to clarify that, if you were looking at your course outline, we altered that way earlier in the semester, and we needed to remind you of that today. So we'll have regular class, as usual, next Thursday, right here, regular time. So the tests, we've gotten some feedback on grading for those tests from last Tuesday. I am sorry to say, I think you guys did not read that book so well. The multiple choice questions on the book, whew, there are some bombs out there. I said at the beginning of the semester, one thing that's super, super important is that you read those books, and I gave you pretty good tips for what to look for. But somehow that didn't pan out so well. But we'll continue on the grading of the short answer. We always do the objectives first just to see how the pulse of the class is. And we'll continue on the short answer. Maybe those will make up for some of the deficiencies on the multiple choice. As usual, the slide identification, fantastic. Everybody always does great on slide identification because you've got pretty damn good visual memories, but not so good on multiple choice this time. So from the lecture before the test a week ago today, the Twitter card question was the sort of synthesis of human factors, and this is one of those where I might not read the Twitter card responses because it's been a week since we had that class, but these were really good, and the Twitter card question was, can you identify an environment that you've experienced that seems to be very strong in terms of human factors? Does it really encourage a healthy, nurturing, supportive life for the people who are inhabiting that building and using that building? And we had looked at some buildings in class that were very good comprehensively in these issues of human factors. These were really good, and I was really super pleased at the fact that so many of them were about buildings on the campus that you looked at and said, you know, this building on my campus that I use is actually really supporting my life on this campus pretty well. So there were some good answers that way. Okay, so here are a few of those responses. Someone says, I think the Whole Foods store downtown here in Austin is a great example of a building that takes the human experience into consideration. Starting with the parking garage, the building is able to use new technology to help cars find a space. The escalators include an easy method for shopping carts to move up and down, and various tables are scattered around the area with food for an upbeat social experience. Now, this is a company who understands the power of architecture to make their company successful. And Whole Foods really thinks of the user experience, the human experience in their stores. And honestly, their prices are a lot higher. And their food is great, but a lot of it is, that's a positive user experience. And these days, that's my grocery store that I go to all the time. And the biggest bummer on going to Randall's or HEB or something like that is that, it's just not as pleasant to shop here. And I think that's, again, kind of unconscious, but people say, whoa, I'm going to go to the Whole Foods. I'll have a a positive experience. It'll make me feel like I'm part of a community here, which is great. Somebody else says, I think the SAC handles human factors well. The building shape encourages people to walk through the building. There are many places where students can work together and collaborate. This is very important to students at UT. Having somewhere to collaborate and work together can lead to better successes for students. Someone else says, the Dell Gates Complex, in my opinion, does a phenomenal job of incorporating human factors to allow for easy use and interpersonal interaction. The giant atrium, complete with a cafe and a number of study pods and couches, allows space for studying. On each floor of the building, there are group tables and whiteboards that you have to pass before walking into an actual classroom, encouraging students to interact with each other, even on the way to class. Someone else says, the FAC is a building on campus that I would say encourages collaboration. The main floor is completely open so that you can see everything and everyone. Also, tables and chairs are all arranged in groups so that no one sits or studies alone. It's a great place to work on projects, and you're bound to see someone you know. I think human factors in a building are some of the most important aspects to consider. Someone else says, a place that has success with human factors is a building like the CLA on campus, College of Liberal Arts. I don't see people who are just liberal arts majors there, but students from all disciplines. It has all these hidden, cozy spaces to work, along with a great outdoor patio, so you don't feel too confined. The skylight that connects it to the SAC also makes it feel easily accessible to the whole UT community. Someone else says, I think BELO on campus exemplifies many human factors. Right when you walk in, there's a little coffee shop and table space to work, while upstairs you can look over the balcony and see everything below, making this place less stressful. The high ceilings and openness of the building make it very user-friendly. So then a couple not at UT. Somebody says, the local library in my town is extremely effective in creating spaces for collaboration and community. The many study spaces spread throughout the building allow people to easily navigate the building and find who or what they're searching for with little trouble, yet allows for relatively quiet study alongside louder and more community-oriented spaces. Finally, Central Park is a space that is extremely holistic in terms of human factors. First of all, it provides a natural element of relief in an urban city. It's more intimate and private and calm than the busy, bustling city of New York. There are a lot of human activities, always things going on, and a humanizing presence. But the most interesting thing to me is how quiet it is. Despite all the human activity, it's very serene and calm. One of the things that just blows me away in this class is the difference between Twitter card responses at the beginning of the semester and Twitter card responses at the end of the semester. Those were extremely perceptive, really great examples, really clear kind of understanding of, well, what is the effect this physical environment is having on my ability as a student here at UT to be successful, to work with colleagues, to learn collaboration skills, to have a sense of community, to, you know, all of those things that are super important for the success of UT. And I'm really delighted that virtually every one of those buildings listed is a relatively new building at UT. And I would say that UT has, in the last 10, 12 years, done a phenomenal job of upping the ante on their human factors in their buildings. You can look at RLM, you know, some of those in engineering, totally suck. Oh my God, they suck. And, you know, it just does not encourage the kind of life on this campus that is nurturing for students. And then some of these others that have come later, CLA, Gates Dell, BELO, these are all within the last 5 years. And UT has gotten it. They've figured it out. And that's a really, really positive thing from my point of view in the direction this university is going. Okay, so today we're going to talk about, and really today and on Tuesday, we're looking kind of synoptically at the semester. We had a few intro lectures, and then we had a segment on form, we had a segment on physical considerations, we had a segment on human factors, and these last few lectures are kind of, you know, overview, looking at the whole big picture again. So one of the things that's got to come to your head after, you know, the discussions we've had all semester is, how do you manage to get all of these different factors assimilated together? How can you combine all of these issues of form, all of these issues of physical considerations, all these issues of human factors? How do you make a decision about how to smash those things together? Alvar Aalto, who we've been looking at the last few lectures, when he was talking about the way he designed, he said, you know, first you just do research like crazy, and you try to find out everything you can about the site, and about the program, and about the uses, and about the function, and about the price, and the budget, and the technologies available, and the construction methods. You just try to learn everything you can about this project. And he said, then inevitably, I get a 3 o'clock in the morning feeling. And that's like, you know, when 3 o'clock in the morning, you've been working all night and your brain is kind of addled and you just can't, just, it's overwhelming. It's just overwhelming. And he said, that's the way I feel every time. When I figure out all the things this building is supposed to be doing, I get this 3 o'clock in the morning feeling. And honestly, I think any good architect, it is overwhelming, all these different things that are important and consequential in the success of a building. So then the question comes, how do you deal with that? And there's a very famous architect named Paul Rudolph, who in the 1970s, 80s, this guy was the man. He was the Frank Gehry of the 1970s and 80s in America. He got many, many prestigious commissions, was doing work all over the world. He was dean at Yale. And in that period, he made this statement. He said, in architecture, all problems can never be solved. Indeed, it is a characteristic of our time that architects are highly selective in determining which problems they want to solve. Great architects make wonderful buildings only because they ignore many aspects of a building. If we solve more problems, our buildings would be far less potent. So he's making the argument that you need to select out a few of these issues and concentrate on them and do them extraordinarily well, and then there are going to be other problems you just don't solve. And that's fine. But that's how you make really potent architecture. And in a way, this is a very late 20th century attitude. Many, many disciplines thought this way. So, for example, in science, there was a notion in the latter part of the 20th century that we're going to find the answer. We're going to find the solution to this issue. And it's going to be clean and pure and elegant. And it's not going to be chaotic or confused at all. This was kind of what Einstein was about when he thought there was a unified field theory. And he searched the whole last 40 years of his career, thinking, I'm going to find some clear kind of formula for how the world works. And it's going to be so elegant and so simple and so clean. And so in order to get toward that, he was able to just kind of push aside things that disagreed with some simple model that he produced. So you kind of get the static out of the system and just ignore some aspects that don't seem to fit into that in order to go for this simple, clear solution. And that was a notion that was powerful in the latter part of the 20th century. It was also there in politics. You know, it was a period when Russia was saying, we're going to be a pure socialist country. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his need, pure socialism. That's going to really work. There were other people who were pure libertarians, someone like Barry Goldwater, all about just complete libertarian attitude toward politics. And then there were other people that were pure capitalism. But that's the way. You don't compromise capitalism. You let the market forces go out there and do what they're supposed to do. And these clear, pure models were very, very popular, not a kind of hybrid or compromised version. And you saw the same thing actually in art and in music. In art, you got all of these sequential movements like Fauvism and Cubism and all of them kind of, okay, we're going to be looking at this one issue in art. I'm going to concentrate my entire career on geometry and color. And you get someone like Mondrian, who basically only uses black, white, yellow, red, and blue. Only the primary colors and black and white. And only rectilinear geometry. And for his entire career, basically, hones in on some really simple, kind of boiled down version of art. And does that extraordinarily well and with great refinement. You get who wrote a piece that was 24 bars of silence. I'm just going to deal with the rests in music. I'm not going to think of all those other issues about music. I'm just going to deal with the rests. I'm going to write a whole piece that's 24 bars of silence. So the orchestra sits up there, comes out, and he raises his arms, and you have total silence for the piece. Now that's pure. That's concentrating on one aspect of music and ignore many other aspects of music. So this is a way of thinking in the latter part of the 20th century. And it was very, very powerful in architecture. And you get many architects doing just as Paul Rudolph is suggesting, where you concentrate on one or a few aspects of the building, and you do them extremely well, and you ignore many aspects of the building. And in the hands of really good architects, damn potent buildings. They are strong. They're memorable. They're standing. But the question for today is that the way to make great architecture? Is that really the key to how we deal with this myriad of issues that we've been looking at through the semester? So it's a question for you. What do you think architecture is about? What do you think it should do? Today we're going to be looking at that approach, and we're going to see a number of buildings that did that, and what are the consequences. And then on Tuesday we're going to be looking at quite a different approach, an approach that is more holistic, more balanced, maybe a little more compromised, or one could say energized by synergy. So we're going to look at these two different ways of dealing with the issue of how you focus or not focus on aspects of a building. So the first few buildings I wanted to look at are ones that are very strong in terms of form. And they've taken a few issues of form, and they've said, that's what this building's all about. I'm going to do that to the nth degree, and I'm going to ignore some other aspects of the building, just like Paul Rudolph said. So the first of these is the John Hancock in Boston. This is the tallest building in Boston, still is today. 1975, right in this period I'm talking about. The architect is I.M. Pei, actually Pei Cobb Fried is the name of the firm. And it's an iconic building on the Boston skyline. It sits kind of by itself. And as you move around Boston, especially on the freeways, you see this building from all different angles. It's like a very big piece of minimalist sculpture. It's a trapezoid in plan, a long, thin trapezoid. It's very sleek and elegant. It's made of this very kind of ephemeral blue glass. Sometimes it looks just like the sky. On a gray day, sometimes it turns kind of gray like the sky. On a blue sky day, sometimes it's just perfectly blue, like the sky is. And it reflects the clouds, and it's beautiful proportions, very minimally detailed, looks like just a big iceberg on the skyline there. And it is, it's a powerful piece of sculpture. It changes with different light conditions and different seasons of the year, and it changes with different angles that you view it. It's a very dynamic, very interesting building in terms of form. Now, let's think about it, though, in terms of human use. So for one thing, that long, skinny proportion, very elegant tower, but actually not very good for how people work together on a floor. So it's a very tall building. That means it has lots of elevators in it. And so there's an elevator core in the center that would have all the elevators and the bathrooms and mechanical rooms and all that. And they're in the middle of this skinny building. They kind of separate each floor into a pod at one end, usable space, and a pod at the other end. And then the middle is kind of blocked up by this elevator core. And it means that when this is a big insurance company, and when they have large departments that are trying to work together, people are kind of segmented into little individual departments. And when they first moved in, there was a lot of objection by the occupants that, wait, we used to all be in, you know, a big floor and we could all work together, and now we're all subdivided into these little pods at the ends of each floor. That didn't work so well for the company and for the interaction of people in it. Another thing is it definitely, I mean, if you say, you know, you're a mommy and you work on the 37th floor of this building and you're describing to your daughter, look where mommy works. She works in that building. Well, we're in that building. Well, Jesus, I have no idea where the 37th floor is. It doesn't even look like it has floors. It doesn't even look like it has people in it. It's just this big piece of sculpture. There's something kind of not very humanistic about the fact that you just kind of can't identify your place. And then certainly, as it meets the street, it's just this whack, big reflective glass thing that hits the middle of the city. It's in the Back Bay in Boston, next to Trinity Church. We're seeing right here by H.H. Richardson. I mean, there's a beautiful kind of scale and fabric of the city, and this building completely violates that. It's certainly not very humanistic. At the scale we looked at with periodic natural relief and with encouraging activities and things like this, like no retail on the ground floor, no cafes, it's just whack, big reflective glass object and then a big blank plaza in front of it. Human factors, no, it doesn't seem to be a priority in this case. Then in terms of physical considerations, I mean, obviously, 100% glass building. Same on all four sides. We know how the sun works, and that's not very advantageous in terms of the sun. It actually is made of glass. And reflective glass means that the sun, in the summertime, it hits the building, and it reflects down on buildings in the neighborhood. And because the reflection is so intense here, it will focus the heat in a really extraordinary way down on neighboring buildings. And so very shortly after the building was completed, the neighbors realized that their air conditioning bills were going through the roof because this building was reflecting heat onto them two or three or five blocks away. And they sued John Hancock and said, you've got to pay the difference in my energy bills because you increased my air conditioning loads. And so John Hancock, being an insurance company and not wanting that kind of publicity, they actually started paying energy bills for the buildings around because the building was heating up the neighborhood. So significant thermal issues. When they built the underground foundation for this building, they made a big hole in the ground. And this is in the Back Bay in Boston with tables very high. So they pumped all the water out while they were building this. And as they pumped the water out below their site, it also began to pump the water out from under the site next door. That is a very historic church, Trinity Church, built in the 1870s. It was built on wooden piles that go down to bedrock. And those are big, huge, tree-like wooden piles that support this building. Now, as long as they had water all the way around them, those wooden piles do great, because you cannot have rot or oxidation of the wood as long as there's no oxygen or air around it. When it's covered with water, it actually holds up for a long period of time just fine. But when they took away the water, when they pumped it away, there began to be air there. There could begin to be rot in the wood, and they began to get deterioration of those piles. And so the building next door was beginning to have structural issues because of the consequences of construction of that building immediately adjacent to it. So again, John Hancock paid money to its neighbors to compensate. And in fact, they paid enough money, they completely renovated Trinity Church. It's never looked better in its life than it does now, because they not only fixed the foundation problem, but there were damages to the stone cracking and things like that above. They went in and completely refurbished the whole building at John Hancock's expense. Yeah, some real physical considerations, issues, not maybe fully thinking about water table and on neighboring sites and sun and heat gain. Really, the very, very worst physical consideration issue was not really taking fully into consideration the wind in Boston. The wind, I mean, we talk about Chicago being the windy city, but Boston actually technically has more wind than Chicago does. And when you make a building this shape, so that it's long and skinny, it acts like the sail of a sailboat, and it catches the wind. And then the wind wants to push it in that narrow direction, and the narrow direction doesn't have much structure to resist it. So it's kind of a perfect shape for wanting the building to catch wind and the wind to push it over. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. These big structural loads came on it, and pretty soon it was popping the glass out of the windows. So what would happen is, on one side of the building, the building was in bending, so it's getting tension on one side and opening up, and pieces of glass and fall 40 stories down to the street and go kaboom all over the sidewalk. Or on the other side, where you got compression, it would smash the glass and charge of glass would go down on the sidewalk. And so for about a year, they had to close off the sidewalks all in this neighborhood. Glass falling down was incredibly dangerous. So I was actually living in Boston at the time. It was a huge embarrassment for the city, certainly for John Hancock, because this building did not take physical considerations into account as it should have. Now, the remarkable thing here is exactly what makes it so strong in form, that elegant trapezoidal shape, what makes it problematic in terms of wind. It makes it a sail, and it makes it have these structural problems. So, there are a myriad of things to consider here. In this case, we're going to go for form. Bugger other problems, and the problems became enormous. There was a huge lawsuit. John Hancock sued the architects, completely obliterated that architectural firm, because they had financial responsibility for some of these errors in the building. Okay, another building, another architect that we've looked at that, you know, obviously does fantastic work. This is Lou Kahn, and he did this building in Dhaka. We looked at Sri Banglanara, the capital of Bangladesh, that Lou Kahn designed. Just a few blocks away is this hospital that he designed at exactly the same time, called Ayub Hospital. And this is the great American architect coming over to Bangladesh. He's working on the Capitol building. The people doing this hospital hired him to do the hospital as well. And it was one of those things where he was kind of just given carte blanche to just do us an amazing hospital. So So this was in a period when Kahn was very interested in these pure geometrical shapes. We talked about the power of geometry and these great circular forms on the face of the building. And it not only is circles in the front face, but then the circles go in the 90-degree direction and create this kind of arcade. And then there's another row of circular forms and another row of circular forms, and they're kind of three porches, circular forms that are the front of this building. So it's this whole sequence of three layers of outdoor kind of space. And it's absolutely beautiful brickwork. They use a lot of brick in Bangladesh, so we're using this local material, and it's also very, very powerful the way the light plays against the circles and the geometry, and it's really quite a beautiful sequence of space. You can see all the light and the geometry, and it's powerful. However, that's in terms of form. In terms of human factors, all right, dude. A freaking hospital. It's a hospital in Bangladesh, which is a country. So this is something they need really badly. Healthcare in a very, very poor country. And so there was a budget that was there for building the hospital. At a certain point, he proposes these three porches on the front. That was about half the budget to build these porches. And I think they were going to have 640 beds in the hospital, but if they built the three porches, they could only have half that many beds. So they had to reduce it to 320 beds. If they built the porch, and the decision was made, okay, we're going to build the porch, and we're only going to build 320 beds, and later we could build more beds. We could always add more beds later. So they build the three porches, and they build the 320 beds. It's completely inadequate. When I was there, they had patients up in that little balcony area up there. There were cots where there were never meant to be patients. But they had so many poor people who needed health care, and they didn't have enough beds. So now they're out in the kind of public space there on cots being treated. Was that a good decision to put all your money in these beautiful porches instead of to put your money in beds for people who are sick? It was almost an immoral choice in some ways to spend the money that way. But those three beautiful porches are there. Another issue in terms of physical considerations, we're just trying to have, inside some hospital rooms, some surgery suites, some administrator's offices. Those are the kind of functions that go on in a hospital. They kind of want to have windows, mostly. Well, to really make those circles look fantastic, it's so great when they can contrast with a solid wall within a dramatic cut in it. So little pop, pop, pop windows like offices or hospital rooms might have, they just would look weak and not strong in terms of form if you did that. So Kahn does not do windows like that in the building. Occasionally there's a little courtyard, like you can see right here, and there's some windows off that courtyard. But mostly, a lot of the rooms just don't have windows. So I was there visiting the head of the hospital, like the top administrator, showing me around, and then we go to his office and we sit down and start talking, and the electricity goes off. And that's not unusual in Bangladesh. They don't have a completely reliable electricity supply. So when the lights go off, there's no window in his office. So it's pitch black. We're sitting there in the complete dark. And he just very calmly pulls the drawer of his desk open, candle out, takes a match, strikes it, lights the candle, never misses a beat. We just continue the conversation. And I said, does this happen? Oh, yeah, it happens all the time. We lose our electricity. It's no problem. I said, well, what happens in a surgery suite if they're in the middle of surgery and the lights go out and it's pitch black because there are no windows? Oh, it's a problem. Oh, yeah, we sometimes have a problem, yes. And it's like, what? You can just use natural light. You can use a window, and you can solve that problem and not be vulnerable to the unreliable electrical supply problem. But no, there just aren't windows in substantial portions of the building. Then another physical considerations issue, this beautiful facade with the big circles. Guess what the orientation of that is? Due west. Bangladesh is a really, really hot climate. It's hotter than it is in Texas. And that sun is merciless. And all afternoon long, the sun is pouring through those big openings and hitting those brick surfaces, and that it's actually a black matrix in the terrazzo floors there. It's absorbing all that heat and re-radiating back in the space. So I was there in December. And even in December, by about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it was uncomfortably hot in that space. Basically, you wouldn't want to be there. They said in the summertime that by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it's really hot. And you really can't inhabit those beautiful porches. You can walk through them, and they're kind of cool to look at. But in terms of actually being there or staying there, it's just too hot. The weather. Merciless. So, okay, that was strong in form, not so good in human factors, not so good in physical considerations. Is that a wise choice? A third building, strong in form. This one is low-income housing in La Défense, which is a suburb of Paris. If you go out the Champs-Élysées, beyond the Arc de Triomphe, just keep going west there. End up at La Défense. It's very chichy, high-end suburb of Paris. And in this high-end suburb, now, the French have a little bit different attitude than we do. They're not very happy about a whole segment of the city being one income. They want to have a little more diversity of income. So even though this is a very high-end neighborhood, somebody's got to be the help in the restaurant. Somebody's got to be the maids that clean up in the rich people's houses. And so they have some low-income housing in this very expensive neighborhood. And it's public housing that is supplied by the government. So this is some of that low-income housing. But of course, they wouldn't want it to look tawdry in La Défense. It's a fancy neighborhood. You don't want ugly low-income housing there. They hired this well-respected architect, Emile Ayot, and he builds this series of towers. And they're shaped like amoebas, these shapes. They're covered in this shimmery tile in many different colors, kind of a camouflage pattern. The windows are these little portholes and little teardrop-shaped windows. Very, very interesting, shimmery, sculptural towers. There are five of them that are in an ensemble here together. And there are really striking and kind of gorgeous to look at. And anywhere you look from all over La Défense, it's very distinctive, these beautiful towers. So in terms of form, very, very high priority. In terms of human factors, it is low-income housing. Primarily, it's North African people who have come across the Mediterranean to France to be workers there. There's something just kind of anachronistic about the population versus the sort of high style chic of the building. But then when you actually get inside the building and you look at their apartments, of course, in low-income housing, the rooms are quite small. You don't have a big, spacious bedroom. You have a small bedroom. You have a small living room. So they're tiny rooms, but the amoeba shape means they're very oddly shaped rooms. So honestly, furniture just doesn't fit into this building very well. So I went into one apartment where there was a bedroom, and by the time you got the door and you got a closet, and then you had this amoeba-shaped wall, there was no place to put a bed on a wall. There was no wall long enough for a bed to sit against it. So the bed was sitting out in the middle of the bedroom, and there was barely room to walk around the bed. But it just was like, whoa, did somebody think about this? There's got to be a bed in the bedroom. Somebody's got to sleep here. Is there room to put that furniture in that space? And honestly, there just wasn't. So inside, it's crazy. And, you know, people can't make custom furniture here. They can't afford that. So they're bringing in the furniture they have, and it's just very difficult for it to fit in those apartments. And then when you get to the outdoor environment, this is, they've got lots of kids, tons and tons of kids. But you see what the environment's like around it. It's basically very barren, and you know, there's no place to play. I don't know. It just, was there any consideration of the people who live and how they would? Then there are all sorts of issues of physical considerations, too. Obviously, there's no attention to the sun. All sides are pretty much the same. There would be spectacular views because they're tall buildings, and you can look back at Paris, but everybody's window is this tiny little porthole window, so you don't really get those views. You can see in the window on the right, very problematic windows. I mean, that teardrop shape is a cool-ass shape for a window. It's very distinctive. You can see the way you open the window is it pivots on either side there. Only the pivot and the teardrop shape don't work that well together, and many of those windows were broken. So, and they were very hard to replace because it's a very customized kind of thing. So a lot of them are just left broken. When it pivots, how do you get privacy? So these people had just put a sheet up above it, because how do you make curtains that shape a teardrop? I don't know. And then when the window pivots, then it pushes against the sheet that's there. Just, wow, just not very thorough thinking through of privacy and breeze and maintenance. And but it's cool looking. It definitely. So, does it make sense for form to overpower these other considerations? Now, I want to make it clear, it's not just form that sometimes overpowers other things. So, we looked at this building at Cambridge University by Jim Sterling, the history faculty there. And it's, I absolutely believe this is just one of the coolest buildings in terms of the way factors are worked out, the way the functional organization spaces are arranged, the way the whole thing works is a kind of sense of community. It's really, really good. So you come in from the campus, as we talked about, you have the kind of central desk there, you have all the reading room area here, you have little study spaces over there, you have the stacks here. Everything works together extraordinarily well in plan. The library becomes the center of the whole history faculty. That's clearly where the priority is on that great sort of central space. All the faculty offices and the seminar rooms, the classrooms, everything looks down on that great community space there. You know, this is a well-organized, very sensitive, functional building. And I think it's great in that regard. That seems to have been predominant priority here. But in terms of physical considerations, there are some real issues here. So number one, it's all kind of a glass cascading roof over this library. And the glass is not easy to keep clean. They've got this special mechanism for washing the glass. So you like lay on your belly there and you're trying be the window washer, and then they move it around. But it's so difficult to do that in fact, they just leave the glass just dirty most of the time. So that's unfortunate. So there are issues with how you clean the glass. The other thing is it's just you know, so much glass, and it rains a whole lot in England. Oh my God, it rains a ton. So they have always had leak problems with all that glass. And it's just like this massive, massive skylight that has always had leak problems. And then also, it's not only water that is an issue here, but also tons and tons of daylight that comes in there. And in many ways, the daylight is good in England. They don't have so much issue with heat gain, and they have a lot of gray days, so the daylight is kind of nice from a personal point of view, but books don't like daylight, and books don't like water. So if you think of the way a book is made, all that binding on it, I don't know if you've ever checked out a book from the library and put it on the back of your car behind the back seat where the back window lets the sun in, and maybe you forget it for a couple of weeks, it sits there, and then you pick that book up, and oh my God, all the binding is completely deteriorated. That stuff just goes to hell in the sunlight. The binding material, paper in general, does not like sunlight. It deteriorates very quickly in sunlight. And it definitely does not like moisture. It deteriorates in moisture. So what we have here is a library with lots of books, and we have a real problem with excessive amounts of daylight and excessive amounts of moisture. And in fact, they had a real problem of the books deteriorating in the library. And this was an amazing, fantastic historical collection of books at Cambridge University. And the books are deteriorating in their library. This is important physical considerations and something that wasn't taken into account fully in the building. Then there also are issues of form. Now, if you just look at the building on the right there and you don't think about where it is, I personally think it's kind of a cool building. It's very crisp and very machine-like, sort of, you know, got that technology feel to it. But it's on the Cambridge campus, which is what I'm showing in the slide on the left. And the Cambridge campus is this very soft, kind of historical campus, very gentle, very just soft feeling. And the history faculty building is not soft, it's very hard. To this day, although that building's been there a really long time, it has definitely never become beloved on the campus. Other campus buildings, they love their campus. They love the buildings on that campus. But there seems to be a discordant quality to the history faculty visually in terms of its form, discordant. It has never been accepted in that community. It's still seen as an alien beast. So, strong in human factors, not so much in physical considerations or in form. Here's another example. This one is really cool. This one is the medical faculty. So this is for the School of Medicine at the University of Louvain in Brussels in Belgium. And the architect for this one is Lucien Krol. Now, Lucien Krol has a very, very radical attitude about architecture. Lucien Krol thinks that architects should be like lawyers. They should be advocates for their client. So like a lawyer, it doesn't matter if their client is a murderer. They're supposed to advocate positively for that client and say they're innocent. That's their role. Their role is not to make a judgment about that client. Their role is not to do what they think is best or right in this case. They're supposed to be the advocate for their client. And Lucien Krol thinks that architects should also be the advocates for their client. And in terms of human factors, this makes a certain amount of sense. So what he would do in a project, and he did at the University of Louvain, was he would go around to everyone who's going to be a user of the building. So that's faculty and students and staff. And he said, well, what would you like to have? What would you like for your dorm room to be like? What would you like for your laboratory to be like? And listen to him. And he didn't make any judgments about this. He just said, if you want pink, we'll get pink. If you want chartreuse, chartreuse. We you just listen to your client. And so what they ended up doing was making a building that let everybody have their say about what they would want. So if you want high tech, you get high tech. If you want kind of nuts and berries, Yoldi Village, you get nuts and berries, Yoldi Village. If you want greenhouse, glass, and steel, you get that. If you, you know, whatever people wanted, that they would get that. And then you would just assemble all those things together. So in terms of human factors, this is a very responsive, very deferential building to letting people have exactly what they want. And in some ways you could say, you know, it's a very powerful idea in terms of human factors. Now, how about some other issues? Well, in terms of physical considerations, it's kind of a mess. I mean, there's so many materials and so many joints and so many, and the whole idea was that then as your users change, then you take that out and you replace it and you put what the new user wants, and else comes, you take that out and replace it. Well, not very sustainable. You're constantly under construction. You're constantly throwing things away and putting new things in. And so, of course, that hasn't really happened so much. Also, you know, somebody wants all glass wall. Well, it's the wrong orientation. Well, it's okay. You can all glass wall. So a lot of the climatic issues are not very well dealt with. In terms of physical considerations, it's got its severe. In terms of form, well, I don't know. You judge. There are many people that think this is just about the ugliest building they've ever seen anywhere. Just chaotic and discordant and jarring and a mess. I talked with someone who lived in the building, and they said the very best thing about living in this building is that you don't have to look at it. I'm looking out. It's all the neighbors who have to look at it, and I'm lucky. You know, I don't have to look at it. So he was perfectly. He liked, you know, his unit and all that stuff, but it's butt ugly. I'm sorry, it is. Okay, strong in human factors, not so much in physical considerations. So it's also possible for a building to be strong in physical considerations and maybe neglect the other two areas. So this is a building at MIT by Errol Saarinen, an architect whose work we've looked at through the semester. Looked at his TWA terminal, looked at Morrison Stiles College, looked at John Deere headquarters. This one was meant to be a performing arts facility for the MIT campus and built in the 1950s. So in this period, Errol Saarinen was very interested in thin shell. Structure was one of those physical considerations we looked at. And Errol Saarinen was a master at structure. He really understood structural principles of materials and how they could inspire a building. So in this case, he's experimenting with a new structural idea. And that's the idea of thin shell concrete. So how could you use reinforced concrete to get the maximum span with the minimum amount of material? How could you make it the very, very most efficient? So all that lineage we looked at of domes from the Pantheon to Hagia Sophia and all of those domes that the Romans did, this is taking that one step further. How can you take that perfect geometric shape of the dome? How can you use it super efficiently, making it out of reinforced concrete? This is a long, long span of that dome. And in the middle of the dome, it's only 3 inches thick. That's like amazing. So little material, just 3 inches of concrete with some reinforcing in the center of it. Of course, in the center of the dome, it has the least loads. And as it moves to the outside, it gets heavier and heavier and heavier loads until it gets to the bottom. So in this case, the bottom of it right here, and that's 17 inches thick. So it just slowly goes from thin at the top to thicker, thicker, thicker down to the bottom. It is a very elegant expression of exactly how it's collected in that thin shell. They're distributed to these 3 points as they have a kind of pivot and they transfer that load into the ground. beautiful expression of the structure. And it, of course, he had to think of the whole building process of it, just like Brunelleschi did, building his dome. In this case, you do have steel scaffolding, and what they do is they scaffold it up the whole inside of the space, and then they put the formwork on top of it, and they poured it bit by bit by bit, and built the whole dome, and then they took the scaffolding out from under it. So very, very clever in terms of physical consideration. So let's think about some other issues. In terms of form, actually, I had a faculty member when I was at MIT that said that what Kresge looked like to him was like somebody dropped a basketball from Mars and it two-thirds of it fell into the ground and just the top was left. And then like a bulldozer came along and shaved off three sides of it. It was just, he hated it, thought it was just butt ugly. And it did look like an alien object. It didn't have anything to do with the other buildings around or it's just a thing out there. And not a particularly beautiful thing. I don't know, love it or hate it in terms of form. In terms of actual function, though, and human factors, there are so many problems with this building. Number one, let's just say, okay, how do you come into the building? Of course, you want this to be this sleek, elegant glass sheet so you can see the purity of that structural form there. And he did that with just these simple glass walls. But in Boston, a simple glass wall is not a very good facade for a building. So, for instance, where you want to come in, you would definitely want a vestibule. You would want one set of doors, a little bit of relief, and then another set of doors. Because if you don't, on a cold, wintry day, when you open that glass, that door, the wind comes in, the cold comes in, and the lobby is freezing. And there's just no way around it. And especially in an auditorium where big groups of people come in all at the same time, they open those doors and those doors and those doors. And you get inside, and it's freezing cold in the lobby because all that air escaped. That's why you have vestibules that have double sets of doors in virtually every building in the north. I mean, it's just a thing you do to deal with the climate. But that would have compromised the purity of expressing that structure. So, okay, we don't have vestibules. And that severely compromises the functionality of that lobby. Even by the middle of a theatrical performance, because everybody came in earlier, and let's say it's in the evening, you go out at intermission, and you got to have your coat on. I mean, not just a jacket, a coat on, because the lobby is constantly so cold. Another functional issue. So the idea here was this would be a performing arts facility. They would have theater, they would have orchestra, they would have music, they would have just like sort of the PAC here. And of course, generally, those things have fly lofts. A fly loft is this big box above the stage, and that's where scenery is taken up and down. And that's what makes theatrical productions work. Well, if you put a big box here that was a fly loft, it would completely wreck this idea of the pure dome and the structural system that he was going for here. So he convinced the people that the future of theater is not to have those crazy fly lofts. No, we're going to have much more abstract sets for plays. And that was kind of happening in the 50s. And that we're just not going to need those crazy fly loft things. That's so old-fashioned. Theaters can be much more abstract and avant-garde than that. So they did not build a fly loft. Well, of course, that didn't happen. So now any kind of production that's a traveling production or something like that, they can't go to MIT. There's no fly loft. They can't raise and lower their scenery. So, okay, we don't have those kind of productions in this building. Then another big thing that was going to be there was music. So then you need a certain kind of acoustical performance. Distribution of sound. So actually, this room was designed well for music. That's why the organ's back there and all these musical instruments. So the idea is that the sound comes out and that it bounces back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and you get this nice reverberation in the room. But what you want to do is distribute the sound in the room. That's the important thing in a music space. Well, what a dome does is it does the opposite of that. A dome concentrates the sound instead of distributing the sound. So what happens, sound has an angle of incidence and an angle of reflection. So the sound goes out, it hits a wall, it bounces off that wall, it bounces off another wall, and the angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection. If you have a dome shape and there's a sound in here, it tends to concentrate. All of those angles of reflection concentrate back into one spot instead of being distributed. So you can actually stand right here or right there in that section. And this was, I took my acoustics class here, and we took a little field trip over to Kresge Auditorium, and my acoustics professor, who was Bob Newman of Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, very, very famous acoustician, he's showing us that you stand right there, and if you stomp like that, you stomp and it goes bang, 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 bang. Because what's happening is the sound is going out and back and out, back and out, back and out and back, and it's reflecting off that dome, and it's all coming right back into one spot. It's not distributing around the room, it's concentrating in certain places. So you can sit there on about the third row, and if you have a conversation, you're hearing your conversation come back to you from that dome all around the room. There is another really amazing acoustical phenomena here, which is called creep. So if you actually sit in that seat right there and you talk against that wall, it's a curvy wall that goes all the way around, and standing up where I'm taking that photograph, I can hear it as if that person were sitting next to me. The sound moves around that curved wall in amazing ways. So there are all these really interesting acoustical phenomena, but they are terrible for music. They do not distribute sound. They tend to concentrate sound. And the result of that is that it's terrible for music. So I went to a concert there one time where Bob Newman, my acoustics professor, had been hired by the people running the concert to make the room work for orchestral music. So the only way they could do that is they dropped microphones over everybody in the orchestra, and then they piped the woodwinds much louder than the strings or the horns, because they were trying to rebalance the orchestra because the room wouldn't distribute the sound appropriately. So they had to electronically rejigger the distribution of the sound to send it out to the room and make it sound like a well-balanced orchestra. Even then, it was crap. It doesn't work for orchestral music. It doesn't work for many kinds of music. In addition, if you're going to do a theatrical performance there, you'd like to have dressing rooms so they can change costumes. No, that's the dome comes down really skinny and tight here. There's no room for dressing rooms. So the dressing rooms are down here in the basement, and they have to walk down the stairs, change their clothes, walk back up the stairs. That doesn't work in theatrical performances. Many problems here of physical considerations and of function in the building. So, okay. Another example of a building that's actually quite strong in physical considerations, this one's the Centre Pompidou. We looked at it earlier in the semester as well. Oh, man, in terms of expressing its structure and its mechanical systems, its ductwork, the cooling and the heating, the intake for air, the exhaust of the air, the electrical systems, the conduits, the elevators, the escalators, everything is expressed so thoroughly. This is a building that's all about those physical considerations. But on the other hand, some issues here with other aspects like function. What's inside are really just these big kind of gymnasium-like spaces on each floor. And the idea is that they would be flexible, but the truth is They're just not very good for anything. So if you want auditorium-like space, it's all just this flat gymnasium kind of space. And so you can put all the seating there, but you don't really see the guy at the front very easily. Exactly the same space as the library. Well, okay, you can put desks there, but they're very, you feel like you're trying to study in a gymnasium. It's very not intimate at all and kind of anonymous. Or that same gymnasium-like space, you're trying to look at art there because it is a museum. But there's so much distraction of all these ducts and structural systems and all that, you can hardly concentrate on the art. It's distracting, all of this technology that's all over the space. So in terms of actually functioning as a wonderful library or wonderful auditorium or wonderful gallery space, it actually isn't any of those things. And they've renovated this building over and over and over again to try to get the galleries better, to try to get the library better. But still, it's not very good at accommodating any of the functions in it. It also is a very confusing building to move through. You almost need, well, it does have tons of signage telling you where to go, but because it's just these big anonymous spaces, there's no intuitive wayfinding. There's no natural sort of feeling your way how to get around through the building. In terms of the way it looks, I mean, it's kind of a badass building, but it's in the middle of this very historic neighborhood in Paris, in the Marais. This is one of the very oldest parts of Paris. And there are many, many Parisians who hate this building because it's so discordant again in its neighborhood and in its context. Then another just kind of form issue here is that the building immediately turned very dirty. I mean, it's those electric blue, red, those bright colors, white. But it's a gritty city. It's in the middle of Paris. And so things got dirty very quickly. And it doesn't look that great when it's dirty. And then the other thing is that it's made of fairly frail materials. There are all these cables and metal, and the metal gets scraped and the paint off of it and rusted a little bit, and pretty soon it's deteriorating. And in fact, just 25 years after the building was built, they had to completely shut it down for 2 years and redo it, because to keep those forms so bright and clean and like brand new, they actually have to renew it over and over again because it's so delicate and not very sustainable in that urban context. So again, there have been huge problems with that building too. Okay, so this lecture is kind of a bummer, okay? It's kind of a bummer, I get that. We're looking at problems in buildings. But the Twitter card question today is, would you agree with Paul Rudolph? Is this an appropriate way to deal with the many issues in architecture? On a scale of 1 to 10, you should say at the number 1, I totally disagree with this. This is stupid. This is not the way to do it. Or 10 is, I get it. I think buildings should be, for the potency they get, for the remarkable quality in one regard, it's kind of okay to sacrifice these other things. So on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is, I absolutely do not buy into this Paul Rudolph notion, and 10 is, I absolutely buy into the Paul Rudolph notion, where do you stand, and how do you think this myriad of issues should be dealt with?